I'm going to talk to you about conflict of interest in medicine, and at this talk it posed a number of questions. I just want you to think about where your position is, what you think about some of the issues, whether you think they're relevant, whether you think they're important, and particularly at the end, what we should do next. So I'm going back in 1999-2000. I qualified as a doctor, as a house officer in the John Radcliffe Hospital. And at the time, Jeff Aronson, who's here, was my consultant at the time when I was a house officer, and for about a few years then. And one of the treatments that was very visible and coming to the market at the time was this treatment, which is rofecoxib, or Vioxx, it was known at the time. And one of the things about Vioxx is it was similar to non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, but it was promoted because it reduced the risk of gastrointestinal bleeds, but was marketed as an effective pain relief. And this is one of the seminal papers published in the time. It's called the Vigor Study Group. You can see that in 2000 in the New England Journal of Medicine. And I just wanted to tell you a little story about some of the things that happened in the Vioxx trial and what life was like in the 2000s, in, seems like yesterday, but 20 years ago. So one of the things about the Vioxx trial is Michael Weinblatt was actually worked as a rheumatologist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And he became chair of the safety panel. So any trial has a safety panel. But at the time, nobody knew this, that at the time he owned £73,000 of Merck stock, who were involved in producing rofecoxib. He participated also in the Merck Speakers Bureau and gave presentations in the summer of that year. And not only was he the safety monitor in the chair at their meetings also, and this came out after, nobody knew this in 2000, they had a Merck employee present on the chairing panel. Now, one of the things is with rofecoxib is it was not more effective in relieving symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis, but did halve the risk of GI events, which is important, because if you had a similar treatment like that and it reduced your risk of bleeding, it would be very important for people who had debilitating pain at the time. And rheumatoid arthritis at that time is before the immunotherapy, so there were lots of people with debilitating problems. But there was also this evidence of an increased risk of myocardial infarction, a relative risk of 5-fold more likely, and it was statistically significant. Now, when this result came out, it went to Edward Solnit, the company's chief scientist, who wrote an email, and this has all came out about 5 years later in terms of litigation. It is a shame, but it is a low incidence, and it is a mechanism-based, as we worried it was. So they sort of thought there was a mechanism in there in terms of thrombotic. But you were on an introduction to EBHC course, evidence-based practice. So here's some of the things that actually happened, and here's how this result didn't make it into the New England Journal paper. So just think which of these are appropriate. The first thing is the interim analysis had different termination dates. The GI events were counted for 1 month longer than the cardiovascular events. 3 additional MIs occurred in the rofecoxib group in the month after when the data was not collected for the CV events. They were not reported in the paper. Harm was further minimised by a post-hoc subgroup analysis on indication for aspirin prophylaxis. So they did a subgroup of people who were on aspirin and weren't on aspirin. They also presented the hazard ratio. Instead of saying it's 5 times more likely, they flipped it the other way around and said naproxen was the intervention group and the relative risk was 0.2, 0.1 to 0.7. And didn't give the absolute numbers of events. And although the other results were presented appropriately as the intervention group, so they flipped it for that result. They also proposed in the paper a naproxen hypothesis suggesting that rofecoxib had not been harmful, but that naproxen had been protective. And therefore, naproxen is a treatment of choice because it's cardiovascular protective. Now, coming back to Weinblatt. One of the things about Weinblatt, remember, he had said we need to approve this plan and how we present the result. He's on the safety committee. Now, he was told about the cutoff date 1 month before the study ended. Weinblatt agreed. As a result of the cutoff date, 3 of the 20 heart attacks among the Vioxx patients weren't included when Merck wrote up the study in the New England Journal. and it looked safer than it really was. So not just the five times, it came down slightly. Soon after agreeing to the plan, Weinblatt signed a new consultancy contract to sit on a Merck advisory board, paid him $5,000 a day for 12 days over a two-year period. He received an initial check for $15,000 a few weeks later. Now, this never came out until 4 or 5 years later, because at the time we didn't have the same competing interests that we even put you were involved with Merck at the time. It's not a bad paycheck, is it, if you can get it? $60,000 a year, 12 days a year, not bad. Now, one of the things that then happened is the FDA took quite another time. They took another year, so it was until 2001 till the FDA started to get their act together. But Merck had a relentless series of publications, press releases entitled Merck Reconfirms Favorable Cardiovascular Safety of Vioxx, complemented by numerous papers. There was a million reprints bought of the New England Journal paper, and the company sponsored countless medical education events and symposium at national meetings to debunk the concerns about Vioxx. And it was this message was reinforced, that roficoxib had no cardiovascular toxicity, rather naproxen was cardioprotective. And I can remember that message carrying on into about the middle of 2001 too, and then other studies started to become published. There were serious issues, and it took about another 4 years to about 2004-5 for people to really go to town. And this is in 2008 from people like Catherine De Angelis, who was editor-in-chief of JAMA, I think, at the time. And you can see Joe Ross, who still works in the US, that most of the trials were written by Merck scientists or ghostwritten by contract workers, disguised the names of academically affiliated doctors recruited as named authors. And that was my journey, if you like, the 20-year journey of thinking competing interests really do make a difference. I've been involved in the direct prescribing of Vioxx. In 2001, I can tell you there were significant numbers of pharmaceutical representatives camped in hospitals taking junior doctors out for lunches and dinners. And I think it's interesting, that evolution, and here's like a paper in 2000 in JAMA showing that there was quite a significant amount of evidence already emerging. There were 29 studies that had already found, that were looking at competing interests in the issue of physicians in the pharmaceutical industry. Is a gift ever just a gift? And one of them is worth having a look at, and that just came out a year later, with this one of Principles and Pens. It's quite a nice title, isn't it, for a study? Attitudes and Practices of House Staff Working Towards Industry Promotions. So what this study is, what it did is looked at about 117 residents and did a survey of them and started to ask them about some of the stuff that was going on across the board. So interestingly, the first is, this is it appropriate or somewhat appropriate for you to receive this gift? Okay? Nine types of promotion assessed. So you can see receiving an antibiotic guide, about 90% said okay. Conference lunch, dinner lecture, article pen, all scored very highly. Then you get to about 60-70% for a social outing. 7 out of 10 doctors say yes. Textbook and a CME trip. And then I was right down here, about 15% think it's all right to have luggage. What that luggage is for? I'm not sure. But the next slide, though, is incredibly interesting. Now, this is the perceived influence of representatives on prescribing practice. So if I receive money, yeah, I'm the grey box, yeah? So if I'm receiving a gift, I think there's no influence on me. However, if you receive a gift, you're in the black box. So if you receive a gift, it causes a lot of influence on you, but it never causes any influence on me. And I think that's a really interesting, because anybody you'll ever talk to about competing interests and conflicts will always say it has no effect on me. But boy, does it have an effect on you. They both can't be right, can they? And so, of course it cannot be that only other people are influenced by promotion and not me. And so, there was also data at the time, and I remember this, and there may be, there probably only Jeff, everybody's a bit younger 20 years ago in the room. But what they'll remember at the time is, as you walk around a hospital, many of the things that you used in a daily basis were somehow given to you. And one of the things that I always remember were tourniquets. So we would carry lots of items. So we'd have our white coats and be stuffed full of items. And actually what you can see in them items, when they did this residence in this JAMA also, they found the percentage that actually had commercial branding on. And so 30% of reflex hammers had some commercial branding on. And there were all these, even a stethoscope tab was up to 50%. Penlight, and you can see by the time you get to a reference book, somebody had given it you for free, and it had a commercial branding on. So we were like, basically, we were like when you see the motor drivers nowadays with commercials stuck all over us. That's what we were. Now, even more so, when you look at the disparity between patients and physicians. So when we talk about the percentage that considered a gift inappropriate, whatever that gift is, you can always see that patients think it's far more likely to be inappropriate compared to physicians. And that when you think it's influential, patients think it's far more influential than clinicians do. And I think there's a complete disparity in how the public views what's going on compared to within when clinicians take gifts, whether it's influential or whether it's inappropriate. Now, this is the bit that comes in within the bit, and I think this is the Katz paper in 2003, All Gifts Large and Small Towards an Understanding of the Ethics of Pharmaceutical Industry Gifts. The obligation to directly reciprocate whether or not the recipient is conscious of it tends to influence behaviour. Feelings of obligation are not related to the size of the initial gift or favour. That position is eroded by a significant number of people who receive gifts, considering there is no relationship and no reciprocation. And I think these messages were clear in the early days. Now, I was discussing it, if you're not really sold on the idea of, well, industry sponsorship has an impact, I think this paper by Deborah Barnes and Lisa Burrow is one of the best examples of why it matters. And this is a review article on the health effects of passive smoking that reach different conclusions. And them conclusions is passive smoking is not harmful or passive smoking is harmful. Now, if you look at the data, you can see that passive smoking harmful, if you consider it's harmful, out of 31 authors, only two who are affiliated to the tobacco industry think it's harmful, compared to 87% who are not affiliated to the tobacco industry. If passive smoking is not harmful, you can see it's the other way around. And if you calculate the odds ratio on that, you end up with an odds ratio of 88 for author affiliation being the most likely impact on the results of whether it's harmful or not. And I think, you know, we all think now, well, the regulation's changed, hasn't it? The regulatory position is we don't smoke in places because we are pretty clear that passive smoking is not a good idea and it has significant impact. But this is what was being fought again 20 years ago to establish these positions. Now, when you think about the position, and one of the things I've done is try to understand where do we make decisions along this pathway? How do we get to our current regulatory landscape of what makes a difference, what not? And what there is a confusing array of acts, legislation, and a confusing array of what I call policies and guidance. So the bit at the top is actually legal acts that exist in US and other countries. Down here is sort of guidelines and policies that try to tell us what we should and shouldn't do. And most of them are voluntary. But the first one probably is in 1980, is the US Congress Bayh-Dole Act, which required investigators to disclose financial conflicts to interested parties, including regulators, institutional officials, and funding agencies. That was the first one that mandated any legal requirement. But you can see there was quite some time before we get into 2007, the FDA Amendment Act. But what I wanted to do in these policies and guidelines is draw one of the most probably influential was this 2009 Institute of Medicine's report. And they appointed in 2007 the Institute of Medicine appointed the Committee on Conflict of Interest in Medical Research to examine these conflicts in medicine and try to somehow think, what are they? How do we limit them? Because they're out of control. And they're out of control because what we've just seen in the first 2000 to 2005. Now, in that report, there are some very revealing pieces of information. Data suggests that these relationships, that's the relationship between physicians and the industry, may influence physicians to prescribe a company's medicines even when evidence indicates another drug would be more beneficial. Now, also within that is the public also within that, sorry, I'm going to just go back, I missed one out. As a general rule, that researchers should not conduct research involving human participants if they have a financial interest in the outcome of the research as well. Now, I find that fascinating. That's really quite an interesting. That's 209. Any institution I've worked in, a research institution, will have a difficulty in answering that in the affirmative if they're also in some way conflicted by taking money as a competing interest. Now, also within there, is the public needs to be able to trust that physicians' decisions are not inappropriately influenced by their financial relationship with industry. Now, this is a key principle. If we're going to do research that matters and communicate that matters, there has to be a sense of trust. Yet we've shown in the early stuff that the public thinks taking gifts and being involved in industry is influential and not appropriate, whereas we think it's okay. Now, one of the responses to that in the US, which I think was a huge step forward, was what's called the US Sunshine Act. Anybody aware of the US Sunshine Act? Quite nice, appropriate on a day like today where it's sunshine, isn't it, in the middle of January. But it's called the US Physicians Payment Sunshine Act. It's a federal law that requires all pharmaceutical, biologics and medical device manufacturers to disclose payments and transfers of value to the US teaching and hospitals. And one of the things is it makes the interactions more visible. So it's not the responsibility of me. If somebody pays me as a device manufacturer or a pharmaceutical agent in the US, and that payment is a certain amount, then actually what they have to do is they have to tell me, yeah, they have to report it, what they've paid, onto a central database, yeah? And they have to submit that to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services on an annual basis, yeah? And including that is all payments of transfers of value over $10. It wouldn't be much under $10 you could transfer me, could you? Probably that's, I'll give you some change for the bus fare. But over $100 means you have to report everything to that institution. And you have to be required to see there at the bottom, you have to report research payments made to the institutions conducting research on the manufacturer's behalf, including the names of the PIs. And that appears on a database that you can search freely. And it includes pretty much every type of payment, whether it's educational or not. And the impact of this is ProPublica of those. Now there's proof. Doctors who get company cash tend to prescribe more brand name meds. And what ProPublica did is get the data and look at the relationship of the data for payment and look at the data in relation to prescribing. And what they found is doctors who received payments were in general twice as likely to be high brand name prescribers than doctors who did not receive payments. That's where you've got a generic equivalent and you could take a branded product that obviously costs you more for no added benefit. But in addition to that, there is a fault very high, and if you get to the very doctors who receive payment were 2 to 3 times as likely to have very high net brand name prescribing than those who did not receive payments. And what we're seeing is a very small number of doctors can be responsible for a lot of high-level prescribing. And I've become recently aware of that in the opioid crisis as well, that actually much of the high prescribing can be shut down to a very small number of doctors who are highly influenced. Now, whether that's all from competing interest or not, we can't tell in this country because we don't have a database like this. What we did instead is have the ABPI code, the British Pharmaceutical Institute code, and that required pharmaceutical companies to disclose monetary value of support with a value of £250 or more. That threshold was removed in 2012. However, it was voluntary. Okay. And I was on the way here, on the way here, Jeff and I was walking out of my office, and I ran into Ben Goldacre, and I said, I'm gonna take your name in vain, Ben, because this letter he wrote to the BMJ, which was in 2014, is problems with ABPI proposals to release data on payments to doctors. And he basically said the plans to release this information through its own website, it says, to provide a one-stop service with web pages for patients visiting to find about their doctors. In reality, this will mean that a flawed and incomplete data set is presented to the public. The reason being is it's completely voluntary. You can have your name redacted and removed. You have to agree. So the industry has to say, we'll put it up there. You then have to look at it and say, I'm happy for it to go up there. You can aggregate the data if you want, and you can even say, I don't want it. And what's happened is only about half of the people have agreed to have their data up there, and not many people have agreed to have their name. So they may put it up there and say, you can see in Oxford somebody's had money from Bayer and it's X, but I'm not going to tell you who it is. And they even brought another version of this called Disclosure UK, which is the version 3, if you like, of the website. It plays a vital role in the development and delivery of life-enhancing, life-saving medications. And this site says, we want to ensure that patients and others have confidence that this relation is open and transparent. And this is why the pharmaceutical industry is taking the lead on disclosing details of payments and other benefits. I want you to think about that. Now, you could go in the research and find papers like this. This paper by Shia Molinari and in 2017, which looked at the disclosure data in 2015 and 16 and said, basically, there's key deficiencies. There's huge problems. But you don't really need to do that. You can do what I did last night. You can go to the database, go into Disclosure UK. You can look at your institute, as I did for Oxford University, and look at how much money was disclosed to Oxford University. So in 2016, now, minded, the income of medical sciences in Oxford University is about 450 million, I think, right now. And in 2016, there was £478,000 disclosed in industry payments. In 2017, it was £95,000. And in 2018, it's £32,000. Anybody looking at that would either say, A, we're in deep trouble, we're going out of business pretty quick. Or would look at it and think, we're not taking it serious. And like all databases, when they're voluntary, when it first came out in 2016, there's a bit of activity to try and show what you're doing is the right thing. That's why it's gone up. But a year or two later, people have gone, nobody cares, nobody's looking, there are only one or two people who can be bothered to do what I'm doing right now. And actually, why even bother in 2018? And I suspect by 2019, it'll be zero. Therefore, voluntary disclosure, whatever you do, doesn't work. And other countries have realised this. Within the hierarchy, you can see there, Australia. How many people would know that Australia has its own Sunshine Act? France has its own Sunshine Act. In fact, right now, there is, in addition to the US, Portugal, Denmark, Australia, South Korea and France all have versions of the Sunshine Act. And for instance, France establishes public accessibility to the transparency in healthcare database. But I mean, South Korea has also seen the light on this, thinking it's important, as we say, for trust to develop a system where people can go and be accountable and look up who's being paid what. Whether this is because we think in private payment systems it's more important, somehow there's a belief in the national health systems, this can't go on. Whereas in private provider systems, it's like not only are you in the back, you're being paid more if you prescribe these drugs from the manufacturer, your insurance base might be influenced as well. That could be some reason. But I was asked basically, and one of the French have just published a paper by Goupil and colleagues, looked at the French database. And what it showed in the French database is that gifts to French GPs are incredibly common. 88% of GPs have received some gift in France. And of course it's linked to poorer prescribing in those that did. And so once you know that level's going on, you think, wow, it's incredibly helpful to understand this. And it helps the French, I think, right, where is our prescribing? What are we actually trying to achieve? So coming to where we are now, look, there's a wealth of evidence as well that interactions between physicians and the industry generally, and sales representatives specifically, is associated with physician attitudes and their prescribing habits. And this is a systematic review published recently in 2017. And what it shows in there is you can see the behaviours just here as you go up, you go down. The top one is gifts. And so it'll tell you where we've got attitude and where you've got direct studies that show you there's an impact. Drug samples, pharmaceutical representative speakers, honorarium research funding, conference travel, industry paid lunches, CME sponsorship, and interaction with sales representatives. That's what that is. And you can see in prescribing behaviour, out of them, six of them have an impact on prescribing behaviour. Irrational prescribing is linked to pharmaceutical representative speakers. And you can see doing their conference travel, increase in prescribing of the sponsored drugs, increase in with industry paid lunches and with CME sponsorship. And interaction with a representative leads to high prescription of the company drug. Therefore, all of them are designed to do what they say they do on the tin. Otherwise, why would they even bother? Nobody would do any of that funding if it didn't have a direct impact on prescribing behaviour. That's what the industry knows. That's why they keep doing it. We haven't even touched on the bit here within all of this, of the impact on guidelines and whether that. But there is also an impact if we looked here that if you've funded guidelines, you'll get the decisions you want and the recommendations towards your sponsors' drugs. Therefore, about just before Christmas, writing with Margaret McCartney in Lancet, we produced this, Healthcare Conflicted, Confused and in Need of Change. I have to say I was slightly surprised that the Lancet took this, but somehow there means to be potentially a bit of we need to have something in the area because I think it's coming back. We had a cycle in 2000 where we started, it was a huge problem. Many people thought it was solved, but actually the problem is starting to come back in a way, in different ways, whether it's funding research, whether it's funding guidelines, whether it's coming in the back door. But what we said in that is that we need a statutory declaration of interests by all professionals and individuals. And that employers and regulators require annual declarations that should simply request it through a central register. That is not that difficult. So if you're a clinician, at the point of GMC registration, which occurs annually, it would not be much to make an annual declaration of your conflicts of interest as a start. Now, I have always thought if you wanted to be really effective in healthcare, in evidence-based healthcare and taking positions, you really should just follow things that were a good idea and basically should have been done 15 years ago. And if you go back to 2005, the fourth report session, Influence of the Pharmaceutical Industry in the House of Commons Health Committee, is the report together with formal minutes, says in there, doctors in particular, key opinion leaders should be obliged to declare significant sums or gifts they receive as hospitality. Professional bodies should maintain a register of these declarations. That is now 15 years old, that statement, and has not happened. Therefore, one has to happen. What's the purpose of the House of Commons? What's the purpose of Health Select Committee if they make direct recommendations and they're not followed through? What happens is they get kicked into the future, and a few years later there are other recommendations and these are put on the back burner and hopefully forgotten. So what could you do in the face of that? I think there are two things you could do. The first thing is, if you go to university pages, while we're waiting for this register, you can put up your conflicts of interest and payments. It's been a mystery to me why universities just don't say, everybody has a bio page, why don't you at least keep your own conflict of interest up to date on that site? Now, it's interesting, there is direct evidence when you go, and there's a systematic review of conference proceedings, and the average time that people put these up for is about 20 seconds. And that's it at conferences. So I think when we see this and people say, here's my conflicts of interest, it's like, admonish me and I'm moving on, is I think the public needs to be able to access and just go, I can see who's paying you. It's not about me and you saying we're all right. It's about, does the public get access to know who's paying you or not? And I think that's important, because if the NHS is paying me and I'm saying something about the NHS, I'm conflicted, aren't I? So that's where you get the transparency of your declaration. The second thing is, this is called Sunshine UK, which Margaret McCartney is developing and I'm slightly involved in, and it's going forward. But what this does is allow you to make your own decoration as a doctor, and if you have a GMC number, you can put go on there, and I'm on there, and then it allows people to find a doctor, and it's a sort of website as a holding place while we're waiting for people like the GMC or our government to get their act together. So I'm going to finish there with where we started. The question is, where did we start? Should doctors with commercial interests lead research on their products? Should we forget conflicts and discuss declarations of interest instead? Who should hold and maintain conflicts of interest registers for doctors? Should practicing doctors work with the pharmaceutical industry as well as serve on guideline committees? Should researchers with extensive final interests be disqualified from studies of their own products? They're the sort of questions right now, in an ever-commercial world, that we need to seriously think about, and think about what should be done differently, because there's a fundamental problem at the moment is the public just doesn't trust us when it comes to assessing the evidence, informing them about decisions, and making decisions on their behalf. Thank you very much.